Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is always a privilege to have with us a man who brings uncommon intelligence and extraordinary experience. He has rendered incalculable service both in and out of uniform as one of the national security practitioners of the First Order in our country. He is Admiral James Ace Lyons, retired United States Navy. He formerly served, among many things, as the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. I'm most proud of the fact that he is the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee and an active contributor, both with us and elsewhere, to the public policy debate these days. Admiral Lyons, thank you for taking a few minutes. So good to have you with us. Welcome.
Nice to be with you, Frank, and your listeners.
Let me talk to you, sir, about part of the world, as I say, in which you had very, very important responsibilities, namely the Western Pacific, Northeast Asia specifically, and most particularly, North Korea. Admiral Lyons, as you look at what's going on at the moment with respect to the rising threat from the North and the Trump administration's emerging response to it, what's going on?
Well, actually, we've abrogated responsibilities for years by letting North Korea to pursue a very determined nuclear weapon program that threatens not only our allies in the region, but has the potential to be threatening our own homeland. And this has gone on well beyond any acceptable limits and must be brought under control and eliminated. Actually, the south of the Korean Peninsula should be denuclearized, and there are several ways to accomplish that. Of course, China's got to be a major player. But most people, you know, when they think of Korea, they forget that North Korea is the off-site laboratory for Iran. That's where Iran is doing many of its laboratory experiments and operational tests. You've got a whole flood of Iranian technicians and engineers in North Korea. So when we talk about North Korea, we also must all be talking about the Iranian nuclear weapon program as well.
Yeah, this is a hugely important point. And we'll be discussing both of these topics a little bit further with our friend and colleague Fred Flights. But Admiral, let me just say, as you look at issues like the deployment of a carrier battle group up towards North Korea. First of all, why did it take so long to get it up there after its dispatch to those waters was announced? And second of all, does that bring real capability to the United States if, God forbid, military options do have to be exercised there?
Well, it does. Of course, the delay, they had a scheduled exercise with our allies and who had already deployed their forces to participate. So they really had to wrap that up and then proceed to the area where they're operating now. But, of course, we also it's not only the carrier battle group, it's our other sister services resources as well, including the U.S. Air Force and what we preposition in Guam, B-2, B-1 bombers, deployed also our nuclear submarines, both the attack and our ballistic missile submarines. We bring all of this to the area. It's a total package. And, you know, the message that has to be given to North Korea, you launch a nuclear weapon, North Korea will no longer exist. It is that message that needs to be delivered. And, of course, in my view, regime change in the North is what is required, what's gone on there for the last 50 or 60 years is unconscionable.
Well, let me ask you in that regard, Admiral Lyons. The Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, has been signaling as recently as this morning that actually regime change is not what the United States government has in mind, that we just want the North Koreans to give up their nuclear weapons, the Korean Peninsula to be denuclearized, as you say. And if that's the case, apparently we're going to be good with having this odious regime remain in power indefinitely. Do you think that that actually is a tenable position, Admiral? And if not, can we actually afford to be signaling that that's what we'd settle for at this point?
Well, my view is that they're probably right now are trying to defuse the immediate situation. I would hope that would not be our final position, because you're never going to have any type of stability that we are looking for, economic development for the entire Korean Peninsula with Kim Jong-un remaining in power. I mean, this dynasty, this godlike dynasty that has been thrust on the North Koreans is really unconscionable, and in my view, must be the end of the day, must be removed.
Amen. Admiral, as you mentioned, one of the incredibly important players in all of this is China. You have spent many, many decades monitoring, being prepared to contend with, and also dealing with the Chinese government. There are some, including our guest Fred Flights momentarily, who argue that the Chinese seem to now be increasingly concerned in their own right about this proxy, this client state of theirs. I'm a little skeptical about that. Where do you come down on it, sir?
I am with you on this, Frank. When in a communist regime, history tells us, communist regimes don't scuttle other communist regimes. A lot of this here is the touchy-feely good stuff that we see going on. Certain small sots not only the Trump administration, but so they can display to the world some little tidbits that they're doing. But as far as really threatening the elimination of their client state, I don't see that happening unless there's some major dramatic change of events.
Yeah, I don't see it either, needless to say. Admiral, let me ask you about a controversy that has erupted in recent days. Our friend and colleague Jim Woolsey, the former director of Central Intelligence, has been warning for some time now that a particularly dangerous aspect of the North Korean nuclear capabilities is that they may have placed a nuclear weapon already, or could shortly do so, on satellites orbiting the Earth, which, if detonated in space, could create a devastating electromagnetic pulse effect on our country. National Public Radio yesterday, having reported on that with Jim the day before, did a piece that I was frankly horrified at. It featured a professor from Middlebury Institute by the name of Jeffrey Lewis, who proceeded to laugh somewhat hysterically, I must say, at Jim Woolsey's warnings. What is your professional judgment about the reality of this threat of electromagnetic pulse and the necessity of taking it very seriously and taking steps to prevent it from afflicting us?
It is a very serious threat to the future survivability of the United States of America. Let's face it, we know what the impact could be if we had an EMP attack. The fact that North Korea currently, as we are talking, has two satellites in orbit over us every 90 minutes, and the potential that they could have some type of explosive device in those satellites, which could cause an EMP type of attack, to me, is totally unacceptable. And in my view, I would be eliminating those two orbiting satellites. You don't play Russian roulette with this. This is our future.
Admiral Lyons, as usual, you have put the point brilliantly and very straightforwardly. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us and for the great work that you continue to do for us at the Center for Security Policy and for our nation. We appreciate your service in uniform as well as that you were rendering since you took it off. Keep it up, my friend. Stay well and come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we will be speaking with Paul Coyer about the national security implications of the meltdown of Venezuela and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined, I'm very pleased to say, by a very bright and relatively young comer in the international arena when it comes to the interests of the United States and our national security. He is Dr. Paul Coyer. He is, among other things, a research professor at the Institute of World Politics, a contributor to Forbes.com. He also teaches at the École Spéciale Militaire de Sancerre in France, the West Point of France. A remarkable man and a good friend, and always welcome here. Thank you, Paul, for joining us. Good to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
Paul, I know you have family in Venezuela, so I want to talk a little bit about some of their experiences as well as some of the high drama that is playing out at the moment in Caracas and elsewhere across that long-suffering country.
Frank, you're absolutely right. And there are, as you know, a number of negative national security implications for what's going on in Venezuela. As I mentioned in my recent story for Forbes that I posted, I think, Wednesday morning, one of them, among the many, is the fact that it is a security concern to its neighbors because of the masses of refugees that are pouring out of Venezuela's borders across the porous border into Brazil on one hand, Colombia on the other. And Venezuela, among Latin American countries, and is, has just produced a number of one of the highest numbers of refugees, actually of any country in the world, and asylee claims to the United States. And then, of course, you have a national security concern that is wrought by massive Russian armament sales of the last decade or so to first Hugo Chavez and then Nicolas Maduro. And now the major problem is that Nicolas Maduro is saying that in order to maintain his hold on power, he is going to use military weaponry and arm. He already has 100,000 colectivos on the street. These are armed criminal gangs, thugs that the government gives weapons to suppress the Venezuelan people.
Paul Coyer is our guest. He is a columnist for Forbes.com, also a research professor at the Institute of World Politics. And Paul, you were talking about Nicolas Maduro arming large numbers of Venezuelans. I've heard as many as 500,000 AK-47s are going to be distributed. That's a problem, of course, internally, but to what extent do you think that given the volatility of the situation there and the outpouring, as you say, of people heading to other parts to get food, to get the basic necessities of life, among other things, that we will see, in fact, a proliferation of people who are armed and dangerous.
That's absolutely right. And it's a major concern. And some people have said that this perhaps exaggerated. I would utterly disagree. First of all, I'm a historian, so I look at the record of history. And when you look at the region in Latin America, there's many, many precedents in the past several decades of very similar things happening when a country becomes destabilized, as Venezuela is increasingly becoming, especially when you have a government that is really not in control. You can see that by what's going on in the streets, and you can see their fear by the fact that they want to arm criminal gangs to keep themselves in power. When you have that happening, the government is not in control. And when it's not in control, it's very easy for weapons beyond even AK-47s, which are deadly enough, to get their hands into some of these private criminal gangs.
Paul, one of the other bad actors in the mix, of course, are the Cubans. And you've closely studied what the Castro regime has been up to in Venezuela and beyond. Give us a flavor of what is their role at the moment, the Castro armed thugs and security apparatus and intelligence services in propping up Maduro on the one hand and in perhaps exacerbating the kind of dangers you've talked to for the region and beyond.
Yeah, well, as you are well aware, the Cubans have been working hand in glove with the Chavistas from the very beginning, from the 1990s. Hugo Chavez, there's much evidence, was basically an agent that was run directly by Fidel while he was still alive. The Cuban intel has been using Venezuela as its, I would say, cash cow, but not so much cash cow, so much as petroleum cow, among other things. And it's been a parasitic relationship. And so the Castro, Raul Castro and the regime in Havana will not allow Caracas to go without a fight. So we're not even just dealing with the Chavistas' determination to hold on power. We're dealing with the heavy military presence of these colectivos. Many of them are Cubanos, are Cubans, as well as Iranians. And neither one of those two want to see Maduro fall.
So when you talk about going without a fight, what does that look like from the vantage point, perhaps, of folks like your family in Venezuela, Paul? Are they seeing, obviously, in these demonstrations on the streets of Caracas and other cities around the country, increasing repression by the government? And is that dissuading the demonstrators from going into the streets?
No, not at all. At this point, the demonstrators are enraged. And frankly, they're desperate. When you have a country of 30 million people where almost everybody is starving, they don't care anymore. They're desperate. They're seeing their families starve. We're seeing videos pretty much every night that my wife's friends and family send us, or that we find through other means, that are posted online of these colectivos and these Guardia Nacional and others that are going around assaulting and shooting and killing protesters and trying to invade apartment buildings where they see people filming them from the windows. They'll shoot into the windows. And I'm watching this on a daily basis. But the people are not being cowed. They are, frankly, pissed off, and they're going to keep this going.
Let me switch gears slightly with you, Paul. One of the people who has been promoting this dialogue, as it's called, between the Maduro government and the opposition, it's done everything imaginable to suppress, is Pope Francis. Just talk a little bit about the role that Francis has been playing in Latin America.
Well, I mean, first of all, most people respect Francis's view on poverty and his genuine attempts to help the poor. That's not in dispute. That's wonderful. However, when you contrast Francis's defense of basic human freedoms with that of John Paul II in his neck of the woods, so to speak, in the Soviet bloc in the 1980s, where he was as full-throated in defense of freedom, which is why the Soviets tried to kill him in the early 1980s, Francis comes across much poorer, to understate things significantly. And I think a lot of people in Latin America, even devout Catholics, are very disappointed that he not only has not defended them strongly, but he has appeared to give his moral authority, in a sense, to the Castros by going and showing up with Raul, and I believe he kissed him on the forehead or something ridiculous like that. But when you have a pope, a figure of moral authority, doing that, that doesn't defend freedom, as I said, and that is very disheartening for people that are fighting for freedom with their very lives.
Let me ask you about this trip in terms of speaking out for freedom. One of the things that I've been particularly frustrated about, as have many, I think, Catholics and non-Catholics for that matter, is the degree to which the Pope seems to be, if not turning a blind eye to Sharia supremacism, certainly not condemning it as forcefully as he ought to, and arguably he's even enabling it, emboldening those who engage in it. Your thoughts quickly on that, Paul Coyer?
Well, very, very quickly. I mean, I have many, many Muslim friends, as we all do, many of us do at least. But at the same time, you have to speak the truth. You have to say that there are the foundations of Islam, both in the Quran, the Hadith, the Sirahs, and elsewhere, the traditions and the legal tradition that's now 1,400 years old almost. It supports this virulent understanding of the faith that we see exemplified in ISIS. And unless you speak the truth and call that out and say that, you are indeed enabling it. So you can say, yes, I know individual Muslims who are wonderful people who do abide by the American Constitution. But the foundations of the faith themselves are causing major problems, and that's why we see the problem in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood. I have close friends who are Egyptian Coptic Christians who have suffered for many decades under the persecution because they are a minority and because they're Christian. And that leads to trouble getting into top-flight universities. That leads to not being able to get jobs that they deserve despite being Fulbright scholars.
It leads to getting their churches bombed and getting themselves killed, too, needless to say. But we will be tracking it, Paul, as I know you will. Look forward to talking with you further about it in the days ahead. Next up, Fred Flights joins us. We'll get his take on the latest developments, scandalous developments, concerning Iran, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Our guest is Fred Flights, our senior vice president for policy and programs at the Center for Security Policy, a career intelligence professional with some 20 years of service in the Central Intelligence Agency. Also, he served as the chief of staff to then Undersecretary of State John Bolton. He was also a professional staff member on the House Intelligence Committee. It's always good to have him for our weekly visits, especially today. There's a lot to talk about. Fred, glad to have you back.
Good to be here.
Fred, I don't think anybody has covered as assiduously and as effectively as you have the unfolding saga of Iran and the so-called nuclear deal, the side deals, the question of whether the Iranians are complying with the deal, whether it matters whether they're complying with the deal. Walk us through current developments, if you would, quickly, on what's been happening, the evolving Trump administration position towards all of this.
Well, it's an interesting story, Frank. There's clearly a battle underway within the administration on what to do about the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. We heard last week that the State Department certified that Iran is in compliance with this terrible deal. Then the next day, Secretary of State Tillerson said, well, it's still a bad deal and Iran is a state-sponsored terror, et cetera. And then the day after that, the president said that Iran is not in compliance with the spirit of the agreement. Well, the fact is Iran is violating the letter of this agreement for a variety of reasons, the most important of which it won't allow the IAEA access to military facilities. And by certifying that Iran's in compliance, the administration legitimized the deal. It legitimized Iran's behavior, which has been awful. But also it was a slap in the face of those who said we should pursue a policy of strict compliance with the agreement, which seems to be out the window. So I'm waiting for the administration to clarify its position. I'm heartened by things the president has said lately about how awful this deal is, but I'm worried that this 90-day review the administration ordered will be hijacked by careerists to keep this terrible deal, because the careerists are Obama people who helped negotiate this terrible agreement.
Fred, there's so many pieces of this that I want to just touch on quickly. Let me just give you a few to chew on. The so-called NCRI resistance group, also known as the MEK, has come forward with fresh evidence indicating that the nuclear activities of the Iranian regime are proceeding apace on military bases, like Parchin, which are off limits to inspectors. Again, you've helped blow the whistle on the lack of real transparency, let alone actual verifiable inspections. Talk about what we're learning about the program at the moment and what it says about the further evidence that this is a seriously deficient agreement.
I think the NCRI, by pointing out possible secret enrichment work, is just proving one of the most serious problems with this agreement. If there is covert nuclear weapons work being done, it's being done at military facilities. And Iran will not allow these facilities to be inspected. The Obama administration would not discuss this issue, and IAEA reports on Iran's compliance won't talk about it. This is a big deal, and that's why I think the Trump administration has to be very clear. Iran is not in compliance with the agreement as long as it will not allow inspections at military sites.
I'm really struck by both what you've just said and how it jives or fails to jive, more to the point, with representations made by some of the treaty's proponents. And I'm not just talking about the treaty Parsis, in effect an Iranian lobbyist who helped shape the agreement, but I'm talking about administration spokespeople, some of whom are still working inside the administration of Donald Trump, amazingly, who have indicated that, you know, there's anywhere, anytime inspections, there's the most rigorous inspection regime ever, you know, we'll be absolutely certain to detect any violation by the Iranians. Doesn't sound like any of that's true from what you've said.
It's not. There are not any time, any place inspections, even though NSC advisor Ben Rhodes said there would be. There's inspections of Iran's declared supply chain and declared nuclear sites. There's a process to get access to suspect and undeclared sites, but Iran says it will withdraw from the agreement if that process is ever used. And we would have to have a vote by other parties to the agreement to get such an inspection. And the British and French are never going to vote with us on that. So basically, these military sites are never going to be inspected. As I said in my book, Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud, this agreement really is a fraud.
One other development on this front, Rex Tillerson, of course, warned about a lot of activity that the Iranians are engaged in beyond their misconduct with respect to the nuclear deal. We had a flare shot at an Iranian boat or in the immediate vicinity of one as it was harassing some of our naval vessels in the Persian Gulf. Is this a serious escalation of provocations by the Iranians? And would it not be more effective, perhaps, to actually send a shot across their bow rather than just a flare if they are perpetuating this kind of misconduct?
Well, Iran's behavior, including harassing ships in the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea, has gotten much worse since this agreement was announced. And you might remember that Obama said that this agreement will bring Iran back into the community of nations. I think the day is coming where there will be a naval confrontation where we will sink an Iranian ship. We simply can't tolerate Iranian ships harassing ships in the Persian Gulf and having the terrorist group they're backing in Yemen, the Houthi rebels, has actually fired missiles at U.S., Saudi, and UAE ships. I think if this continues, there's going to have to be military response.
Fred, let me turn to one other part of the world that I know you have been covering for a long time, both in the Central Intelligence Agency and since you left it, and that is North Korea. We're, of course, having Rex Tillerson presiding over a UN Security Council meeting today in which this topic will be discussed. What is your expectation of the evolving administration position on North Korea and whether it is likely to actually produce any attenuation of the nuclear threat emanating from the North?
Well, I'm encouraged in that the administration has made it clear that this cycle of Iran developing, testing, and threatening to use nuclear and ballistic missiles against the United States, that has to end. They've been using this to extort concessions from us for years. These programs are simply too dangerous for the cycle to continue. But I'm concerned that Secretary Tillerson is saying that we don't want to end the regime in North Korea, and he seems to be indicating that we might tolerate them freezing their nuclear program. The peninsula has to be denuclearized, and ultimately there has to be regime change. And I think this policy is still evolving, but I think we really have to press the administration to take a much tougher approach to North Korea.
Well, the rhetoric seems pretty tough. The reliance on China to solve the problem, the inducements being given to China for that purpose, and not least the extent to which, as you say, Fred Flights, we're signaling to the North Koreans that perhaps direct negotiations might be in order, and that if they only relent on their nuclear activities, that perpetuating this regime may be once again part of a U.S. government policy. I think we've seen that movie before, and it hasn't worked out very well, has it?
It hasn't, but you know, China's now threatening to sanction North Korea if it conducts another nuclear test. If that's true, it could, and the sanctions are serious, that could be a game changer. I think China's realizing these nuclear tests are a greater threat to China right now than they are to us, because as they get more powerful, there could be a containment leak that would leak radiation into the atmosphere, and that radiation could drift over China. I'm hoping we're making that case to China that, you know, this is a threat to you. You have to help us stop this nuclear program.
Well, I hope you're right, Fred Flights. I fear that the Chinese are doing what they've done before, which is using this sort of nasty bit of business in Pyongyang to their advantage and our detriment. But we will, as I say, be on this very closely, and I look forward to doing so with you next week. Thank you so much, Fred, for your time today. Keep up the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we will speak with Bill Gertz, who will give us our weekly tour inside the ring.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with one of the great investigative reporters and national security journalists of our time. He is Bill Gertz. He writes a prize-winning column for The Washington Times entitled Inside the Ring, and he is also the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon. Bill Gertz, great to catch up with you in the Left Coast today. It's so nice to have you with us. Thanks for taking the time.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the show.
Well, Bill, I've been talking to a number of our guests today about North Korea, and I'd like to get your read on what, if anything, the Congress was told that might help clarify just how serious a danger we're facing from the North Koreans when they were briefed by the senior national security leadership of the Trump administration this week.
Yeah, they had a rare White House session with Rex Tillerson, Jim Mattis, and Dan Coats, the DNI, along with Joe Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So based on those, again, it was a closed session, secret, but based on what those principles were there, you could imagine it's about the diplomatic effort to tighten up sanctions. It's a look at what military options there might be, although there aren't any good military options. And then, of course, the intelligence picture. This was basically something that was requested by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. The White House agreed to it. Again, it raised the profile of the issue. Most of the senators who came away expressed their concern that how serious the situation was. I think that was echoed by the recent interview by President Trump when he said we could be looking at a major, major conflict in the area. So this is highlighting the issue that the administration is determined to deal with the threat posed by nuclear missiles and warheads that can go on top of them. In dealing with North Korea,
it was apparently the single most important issue for Barack Obama in passing the baton on to Donald Trump to share his concerns about this problem, too. So this is truly a bipartisan level of anxiety that's being expressed. Bill, as far as I can tell, there's no evidence that these briefers talked to the assembled members of Congress, the Senate in the White House complex, of course, and the House up in its own quarters, about this problem that I discussed at the outset of the show today with Admiral Ace Lyons, namely the possibility, as Jim Woolsey and Peter Pry have repeatedly warned about, that a nuclear North Korea could be orbiting a weapon in a satellite capable of inflicting incalculable harm on this country through an electromagnetic pulse attack. There are some who are insisting on poo-pooing this threat. You've been covering this beat for so long. I know you've studied this closely. What are your thoughts on the reality of the danger of an electromagnetic pulse attack and the necessity of addressing it forthrightly and not whistling past the graveyard?
Well, I think it's clear. There's some new intelligence circulating in Washington that basically says that within the next 4 years, North Korea is going to have a long-range nuclear missile capable of striking the United States. If that's the case, than whether or not it was addressed, and it would only have been addressed if one of the senators probably asked about it. Then, of course, the idea of a North Korean EMP attack on the United States would be a real threat. I think there's also another major threat, too, and that's the idea of putting a short or medium range missile on top of a freighter. And that's also a threat. Again, our long range missile defenses in Vandenberg Air Force Base, California, and Fort Greely, Alaska, we have some 33 interceptors that could stop that. If it were a shorter range missile, then we'd have to deploy our THAAD systems or Patriots. But the threat is real and it's growing. So I think that was kind of the message of the White House meeting.
But your comments on both the reality of an EMP attack, which you've sort of touched on there, but also that it might happen much more rapidly than the time it takes them to get an intercontinental range missile if they simply put it on a satellite, which of which they have two orbiting us right now.
Right. The problem is that the North Koreans, I think they're starting to get the message from the Chinese, and that was partly due to Trump telling Xi Jinping at this recent summit in Florida that, look, if you don't solve this, we're going to solve this. And that really motivated the Chinese to try and do something. And I think we're starting to see some of that because we've been anticipating another nuclear test by North Korea, and it hasn't happened. And the thinking is it's not clear yet that the Chinese may have prevailed on North Korea to not conduct a nuclear test so far.
Let me ask you about one other piece of this, missile technologies. Bill, nobody, I think, covers this beat more closely than you do. The Chinese seemingly are among those that have been supplying missile technology to the North Koreans. The North Koreans are in turn supplying missile technology to others, including the Iranians. Talk a little bit about the trade in this cash crop, if you will, be for these two communist countries.
First of all, the North Koreans have a fairly well-developed indigenous missile program. They make Scud-type missiles, they make medium-range missiles, and they're working on long-range missiles. But they are reliant on foreign suppliers. And we learned this in February of 2016, last year, when a missile test, the debris from the missile test was obtained either by the South Koreans or the United States, and it showed Chinese and Russian parts. Specifically, some components, electronic components and pressure gauges and ball bearings. And so clearly this report, which was released in February of this year, sounded the alarm on foreign intervention and saying basically that the member states, unquote, meaning Russia and China and others, are not enforcing the sanctions that are already in place. So this is clearly one of the areas I'm told by the White House that they are considering what they call secondary sanctions, and that would be to sanction some of these Chinese entities that have been supplying extremely damaging technology to North Korea. For example, actual transporter erector launchers, which are now the basis for a lot of their mobile missiles. Nothing has been done to prevent that transfer from happening again. It happened about a number of years ago, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and they have, that's the basis of their KN-08 long-range mobile missile.
Hey, Bill, very quickly, talk to us a little bit about Susan Rice and your reporting in the Washington Times about the investigation in the House Intelligence Committee, now seemingly focusing on her role in leaking the names of individuals under surveillance, perhaps improperly.
Yes, this was my Inside the Ring column this week, and it talked about the House Intelligence Committee focusing on whether or not Susan Rice and the FBI may have violated Attorney General guidelines dictating how domestic intelligence gathering is to be carried out. This is, again, one of the key pieces in the House Committee's investigation, and they're waiting on the FBI, which so far is stonewalling the committee by refusing to provide needed documents that can explain who ordered the unmasking of Americans' identities in foreign intelligence reports during a foreign intelligence operation that spanned the 3 months of the Trump administration's transition team, that is from November to January. And so this is one of the outstanding questions. She's expected to be called as a key witness in their investigation.
Well, you know, her party line is that she didn't leak nothing to nobody. So we'll see if she stands up to that under oath and what we find out as a result. And I know, Bill Gertz, we will be hearing a lot about this from you at the Washington Free Beacon and the Washington Times. Thanks so much for the superb work you do in both of those outfits, Bill. Check out Bill Gertz's terrific book, I War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill Gertz, thank you so much for that. Come back to us again next week, Bill, and I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.